All right, well, this morning we're just going to jump into our study today in the Gospel of Matthew. And if you've got a Bible and you want to follow along with me today, if you'll head over to Matthew chapter 24, please. And we're in a section where Jesus is giving his disciples predictive prophecies about two specific subjects. Predictive prophecies about two specific subjects. One subject is the destruction of the Jewish temple in Jerusalem, which will bring to a conclusion the temple worship age. It will actually bring to the conclusion. It'll be the end of the age for the first covenant people. And the second subject is the revelation of Jesus as king, the ruler of the earth. So the second subject is what is commonly referred to as the end of the age, or the conclusion of the world's systems, the world's broken systems being done away with and the end of history as we know it. Those are the two themes we need to keep in mind as we're looking at what Jesus says in this attempt, as we, you know, attempt to understand what it is that he's talking about in this chapter. And we pointed out before that people have a lot of differing views about what it is that Jesus is talking about specifically in this section. And all we can really provide is our best theory of how to interpret his words here. But even in that, we need to remember that Jesus' focus tends to be a lot more pragmatic than ours usually are. Jesus deals more with how we should live in light of these cataclysms, in light of an end coming into view, instead of getting into the details of the when and the who and the how, and because those are the things that we get really excited about. That's the stuff we get really intrigued with. And we talked last week about the danger of obsessing over sensational end time speculations and all the different things that can kind of lead us to. And we want to be aware, but we don't want to be alarmed. We want to be conscious, but we don't want to be cowering in fear because of the way the world is. As Christians, our job description never changes. If the world ends in the next minute or in the next millennium, our job description remains the same. We are called to love God, to love our fellow human being, and keep on doing that until the story comes to its conclusion, until our story. Because honestly, for every one of us, there's an end time coming at some point. I mean, that's the reality of it. So our job description never changes in light of where we are in history or anything else. So that's much of the premise that we laid out last week. Jesus talked about what would characterize the world between the time of his ascension and the end, between the time of, you know, the things that signaled the end and the final end. So the age in which we're living in, the time of wars, of natural disasters, of persecutions, of false prophets, and we've certainly seen all of those things in our lifetime and in the history preceding us. We certainly see that as characteristic of the world in which we're living. So Jesus challenged us, as we open this up, to keep our focus in this whole thing, to hold on to our first love, to keep on sharing the good news of God's kingdom in a response to this kind of a world and this kind of an unstable world. And now today, Jesus is going to narrow in on some details that primarily have their fulfillment in the past, but may have a future reflection somewhere. But through this again, we're going to look at how we're supposed to live. This is the second part of our series. It's how we're supposed to live in light of a world in turmoil. How are we supposed to respond? What's our things to keep in mind and to be focused on? So if you're there in Matthew 24, we're going to pick up where we left off last week, starting with verse 15. Jesus is still talking, and he's instructing his disciples, and he says, "When you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let the one who's on the housetop not go down to take what's in his house, and let the one who's in the field not turn back to take his cloak. And alas, for women who are pregnant and for those who are nursing infants in those days, pray that your flight may not be in winter or on a Sabbath, for then there will be great tribulation such has not been from the beginning of the world until now, no, and will never be. And if those days had not been cut short, no human being would be saved. For the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short." Okay, some heavy stuff in this section here. Jesus, in Jesus's day, Messianic expectations were at a fever pitch. I mean, everybody was waiting for Messiah, rightly so. Messiah actually did show up in those days. But one of the favorite books of the Old Testament that people like to go and speculate about and consider was the book of Daniel, the Old Testament prophet book. Daniel was written, as best as we know, during the exile in Babylon, when Israel back in the 500s was taken into exile into a foreign nation in Babylon, and they stayed there for 70 years. And this was a prophecy given during that time. It was a book written during that time. It was a new addition to what many considered to be the Old Testament canon at that time. And it was a book that forecast in fantastic detail the rise and fall of some of the world's empires after Babylon, which have, it's led a lot of scholars to assume that it was written far after that because of its, you know, amazing detail that it provides to it. Daniel's prophecy is in the apocalyptic genre, which means that it's meant to reveal hidden truths and forecasts about the world through some fairly dazzling imagery, through a lot of metaphor and imagery. Daniel's prophecy describes in a series of visions and dreams that the prophet has about how God's kingdom is ultimately going to triumph and remove all of the other kingdoms of the world. That's the basic thrust of what Daniel's prophecy is about. So, of course, that would be very important. The first century Jewish people who are living under Roman domination, waiting for Messiah to come and fulfill this thing of getting rid of all the other kingdoms. In the center of the book, there's images of monsters that wage war on humans and humanity under the rule of one like the Son of Man, is how he's described, actually prevails. And of course, any Jewish reader at the time would recognize that as code for Israel being vindicated over her pagan and Gentile oppressors that she's endured. And in chapters 9 through 11 of Daniel, we've got a section that's very difficult and highly disputed among a lot of people. But in chapter 9, there's this reference to a prince who's going to arise, who will destroy Jerusalem along with its temple and its sacrifices. And on the wings of abomination shall come the one who makes desolate. Those are the words that's used in Daniel. And then two chapters later, it says another reference about an abomination in connection with the temple. It says, forces from him shall appear and profane the temple and fortress. They shall take away the regular burnt offering, and they shall set up the abomination that makes desolate. So there's the terminology that Jesus is using. That's where it comes from. When he's talking about, because, I mean, you know, he throws that in there. For us as Western readers with no background in this, we read something like that as, what is he talking about? But his listeners knew exactly what he was talking about. Most scholars generally agree that the first reference that we have in Daniel to the abomination in connection with the temple is actually pointing to Antiochus Epiphanes IV, or Antiochus Epiphanes, as he's come down to us, the Seleucid king who ruled Palestine from 175 BC till about 64 BC. This ruler was obsessed with obliterating Judaism from the face of the earth. He outlawed the practice of the Mosaic law. He renamed the temple in Jerusalem to being a temple to Zeus. And then he began sacrificing pigs on the altar in the temple, which was, for the Jewish people under Mosaic law, a horrible abomination. So this was an act that actually prompted the Maccabean War, the Maccabean Revolt. One of the priestly families rose up in revolt against this, actually won. They won the battles and regained Jerusalem at that time. And I'm telling you right now, I can see it. I can feel it in the room. Everybody's like, why so much history, Rob? This is boring. But it's very, very important, actually, because of Jesus's disciples, as well as anyone who would have been listening to him at that time. When he talked about the abomination of desolation, everybody there would have understood that thing as a historical event. When they heard abomination of desolation, they would have been looking back into the past. They would have been thinking, yes, I remember when that happened. That was terrible. And the Maccabees took care of that. They didn't look at this as something that was to take place in the future. And what we have to realize is Jesus is right there monkeying with everybody's timeline that they had established already. He's telling them that what they thought was all completed in history is actually yet to be reflected into their future. And what he's pointing to, most scholars agree, is what was talked about last week. We mentioned this last week, when in 70 AD, the Romans laid siege to Jerusalem, brought their pagan Roman standards inside the temple. They killed the priests who were remaining there. So we had these pagan symbols and the presence of death and abomination that led to desolation. And it signaled the end of the temple age. It signaled the end of the age for the first covenant believers. The temple was torn down shortly thereafter. And the temple, guys, is gone to this day. But the fact that Jesus pointed to a past event and intimated to his disciples then that it had a future reflection, we need to be open to the possibilities of another reflection of this somewhere in the future. The possibility exists that this could be reflected one more time, that there is another tribulation somewhere along in the future. I don't think that it has to be in our eschatological framework to be orthodox, but I think we should be open to the idea, given the fact that we see this repetitive cycle already in what it is that Jesus is saying. But in the immediate, what Jesus was warning his disciples about was a local, escapable judgment that was imminent, something that was going to happen in their lifetimes. I say escapable because of the way Jesus describes it and tells them what to do in this whole thing. If you see this coming, it's time to run. Now, the Jewish historian Josephus wrote about what happened when Jerusalem was besieged in his book, The Jewish Wars. And let me just quote to you what he wrote. He said, "All the calamities which have befallen any nation from the beginning of the world were but small in comparison with those of the Jews. In the siege of Jerusalem, no fewer than 1,100,000 perished. It was during the time of the Passover when more than 3 million Jews were assembled." Some scholars dispute those numbers. I don't know. Sometimes numbers in antiquity are inflated, so I don't know. But obviously, a lot of people died. In surrounding provinces, 250,000 were slain. 97,000 were taken captive, some killed by beasts in Roman theaters, some sent to work in Egypt, others sold as slaves. When the Roman army came into the Palestinian region to put down the revolt that had started in the 60s, not the 60s, but I mean the actual 60s, when they first came in and started destroying the outlying regions, the people in the southern provinces of Judea didn't realize it was happening until they got a signal. Not because somebody came in as a messenger to tell them that the Roman army was on their way, but because of the bodies that were floating down the Jordan River. It was horrific. And Jesus even describes, you don't want to be doing this in the wintertime when the Jordan's at its peak. You don't want to be doing this if you've got babies and things like that. This is going to be rough. This is going to be a terrible situation. But he's warning his disciples, this is about to happen. You need to be prepared in your heart to leave your stuff behind and run. Skedaddle out of there. But the only way you can do that, he says, the only way you're going to be able to get out of here is to leave your stuff behind. And there's an important principle in this. Since Jesus' ascension and the destruction of the temple, the clock has been running down on this world. There may be another reflection, as I said, of tribulation ahead. I don't know for sure. It may be yet to be fulfilled. But either way, this place, these systems that we have in place, have a limited shelf life. There's a limited time left on that. We don't know what that is or how long that is. But if we're going to learn from what Jesus says here and live like the world is temporary and passing away, then it means we need to keep a loose grip on material possessions. And this is one of those things that's always been tricky for Christians. Sometimes we get these notions about God that he's, opposed to material, the material world. God is not against material things. We need to get that clear in our understanding. God, Christianity is not some hyper-spiritualized religion that rejects the physical or material world as evil somehow. And if we could just get purely spiritual, everything would be cool. No, we believe that God created the world. He created matter. He created that. Matter matters to God. And his intent is to redeem it, to make it good again like it was in the beginning. That's our relationship to the material world. Our relationship to this material world, to this world that was created by God, is to reflect his future intent, to redeem, to use this world, not abuse it, but to use it and to work towards those things that reflect his redemptive purposes. So having stuff is not the issue when it comes to following Jesus. It's not that he's against that. There's a place for stuff. You need chairs, otherwise where are you going to sit? But it's what place stuff has in our hearts is the issue. That's always been the issue. It's not that God is against matter. It's not that he's against stuff. But he wants to know what place stuff has in our hearts. And this is such an important thing for us as 21st century Americans to take note of. Because we live in a society that is a consumer-based economy. There's nothing inherently wrong with that. That's money and possessions. Those things are all neutral forces. It's what we do with these things. It's where we allow these things to take root in our lives. But, you know, there's nothing wrong with having a consumer-based economy, except that in order to keep that economy strong and healthy, it's important for people to buy stuff, to consume things. And that's where consumerism plays a role. And we are encouraged under consumerism to acquire services and goods in increasing amounts so that we can keep this economy flowing and increasing. To ensure this is happening, then marketing is employed that intends to manipulate our desires so that we will be prompted to consume. It is over the years since this has developed, and it's a fair, you know, it's fairly new in the scheme of the larger history of the world. This is a massive Pavlovian experiment. I mean, you know, you hear the tune. What am I singing there? And who's hungry for a chocolate bar right now? You ring the bell, the dog begins salivating, wants the meat. So this is what we're steeped in. We're birthed into this kind of a climate. We're birthed into a world, into a society, into a culture that places this sort of emphasis and manipulates us towards a greater appreciation for the stuff. And if we're not careful, that marketing will begin to mold our values and our priorities. Our emotional stability, even our identities, can get tied to stuff before we know it. And it becomes one of these things. How much have we accumulated? Our priorities get twisted away from what's important to what we're able to hold in our hands. I read about a wealthy young man who parked his brand new Lexus in the street, and he was so proud of it, and he opened up his door to get out, and as soon as he opened up his door, a truck, boom, hit the door, took it right off. And the guy was stunned at first and then just incensed. And he got his cell phone out right away, and he called the cops, and the police were there within 3 minutes, and he went on this huge rant. I just bought this Lexus. I just got it off of the lot. It was brand new. It's pristine. And this has happened. And now, you know, even if I take it to the body shop, it's never going to be like it was. It's never going to have the same value that it had when I first got it. And the police officer was looking at him and said, man, you've got to quit being so materialistic. You got bigger problems here. Don't you realize what's happened? Your left arm is missing from the elbow down. The truck must have taken it off with the door. And the guy looked down and said, my Rolex! See, the thing is, it's a regular message in the New Testament that we have to be careful not to allow money or material possessions to have a hold on our hearts. You know, there's that adage, and you see it on bumper stickers or things, he who dies with the most toys, what? Wins. That's not true. No, it really is not true. He who dies with the most toys is going to have some questions to answer. Why do you have so many toys when there was so much need? And here, Jesus ties it to the temporal nature of this stuff. Things are ending. This broken world is passing away. This isn't time to grab things off the junk heap and grip them tightly. Instead, Jesus tells us, the rest of the New Testament reemphasizes it, hold things loosely. Allow them to slip through the fingers if necessary or if prompted, trusting that God is going to supply what we need when we need it. He's the one in control of this. He's the one who'll take care of us. We can be free from the obsession of possessions and things and all of that, right? Don't hate me. I'm kind of, talking about this. I mean, Jesus goes on, verse 23. He says, then if anyone says to you, look, here's the Christ, or there he is, don't believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and perform great signs and wonders so as to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. See, I've told you beforehand. So if they say to you, look, he's in the wilderness, don't go out. If they say, look, he's in the inner rooms, don't believe it. For as lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will the coming of the Son of Man. So will be the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven. The powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man. And then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they'll see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he'll send his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they'll gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. All right, this is the third time in this section, in this chapter, that Jesus warns us not to listen to false teachers, false prophets, to doomsday barkers who try to convince us of something happening that's not, or to try to persuade us to adopt values and ideals that are contrary to what it is that Jesus has given us. And he says there, if they come secretly, or they come and say that Jesus has appeared, but he's doing it secretly, he's out in the desert, out in the wilderness, out where nobody else can see him, don't listen to that. If he's in the secret rooms of the temple, don't pay attention. Tune that noise out. This is the thing that I love about Christianity, is that unlike so many of the cultic religions that were formed around one person who got a special revelation somewhere, I got this revelation from God, this is the way it's supposed to be, gather a bunch of followers and we're going to go out and do these things, Christianity and largely the Old Testament is formed around a community of people. You think about the New Testament, we have four different accounts of what happened in the story of Jesus, and a whole community of people come together and experience these things, and it begins to formulate and form from there. This was not a singular individual off giving some great revelation, but it was the product of a lot of people's encounters, and it continues on to this day. But, this is what he's saying, is that if somebody comes along and says, hey, I got this special revelation, it's going to be awesome, Jesus is coming back at this time, or he's going to be over here, or whatever, tune that noise out. And he says his return is going to be like lightning. You ever watch a thunderstorm in the night? You don't even have to see the actual bolt of lightning to see its effects. It'll shine up, light up the whole sky. You know that lightning has struck somewhere. You don't have to see, you don't have to see the corpse of an animal somewhere to know that something has died. You can look up and see vultures in the sky happening. He says that's what is the coming of his revelation as being the king of this world is going to be like. It's going to be something that everybody's going to see. It will be unmistakable. He references cosmic signs occurring, celestial events with planets and stars. I will say, in qualifying that, that could be apocalyptic terminology, metaphor, for the shaking up of earthly empires. It's worded that way in the Old Testament in several occasions. So that could be what he's talking about there. But either way, it's some sort of big shakeup that's taking place that everybody's aware of, that everybody's seeing. And Jesus describes himself as appearing on the clouds with power and great glory and calling his people to him. Those are things that have not happened yet. I mean, if they have, I'm disappointed. But as far as we can tell, those are things that have not occurred yet. And it sounds fantastic what he's describing there. But it's a consistent message in the New Testament. Paul fairly repeats this exact same thing in 1 Thessalonians 4. And his point is this is not going to be happening secretly somewhere where we could miss it. He's out in the desert, you didn't get there in time or something like that. So while we're living like the world is ending, we need to remember that Christ's return is going to happen openly and spectacularly. One major sect that on the fringes of Protestant Christianity makes its claim that Jesus actually already returned, albeit he did so secretly back in the 1800s, and it was up in the heavenlies and nobody saw it happen or anything like that. And honestly, they are just one of a long line of different sects in the Christian church who make similar claims. And the main thrust that Jesus seems to be making here is the very public and open way in which his parousia, his ascension as king, his arrival as king is going to take place. So we don't want to allow preachers of the sensational to get us perplexed or distressed or living out of some sort of spiritual FOMO that we missed out on Jesus' return somehow. And that's the thing. Whenever we get overly speculative and overly hyped up on all the sensational stuff or current events or things like that, and we get ourselves wigged out half of what's happening, and there's this sense of fear, like, ooh, I got to get involved in this somehow. What's going to happen? Am I going to miss the whole thing? Don't worry about that. Jesus, he said, I told you ahead of time, so you know, so you prepared, so you can calm down and realize, okay, these things are going on, but when Jesus shows up, I'm going to know it. When Jesus is here, I'm going to know it. All right, finishing up this morning, let's read verses 32 to 35. It says, from the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts out its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see all these things, you know that he is near, at the very gates. Truly, I say to you, this generation will not pass away until these things take place. All these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. That's where we'll stop today. I love the picture that Jesus ends this section with. You know, he's described tribulation and suffering and upheaval on an unparalleled fashion, what he's describing there, starting with the destruction of the temple, which happens in the lifetime of his disciples. This is what he says, you know, this generation, you guys are not going to pass away before this whole thing begins, before you begin seeing all this stuff happen. That generation, you know, witnessed it. And it's a dire picture. You know, it was an apocalyptic age for the temple age. It was the end of the age for them. There's an end of the age coming for the whole world, and it has this dire sense to the whole thing. But then he says, think about the fig tree, how it puts out new growth, and you know that summer is near. When you see this stuff, realize that I'm near. I'm right outside the door. I'm ready to show up. And the imagery of spring and summer is so hopeful. And I love that he concludes the section like this. And it's a reminder to us, you know, that this is about all things new. This is about new life and new beginnings, all things new. It's a reminder that while we live in a world that's ending, we need to remember that our hope is in a good ending. It's in a good ending. God has good things in store. I used to have a big tree out in my front yard that you know, every year it was not a tropical plant, and so it was a hardwood tree, and it was one of those that every year in the fall, you know, the leaves would turn down here. I'm from the Midwest, and so when the fall would come, it was dazzling colors and beautiful and everything. Not so much here. Here, the fall comes, everything goes brown and falls. Okay, that was nice. But every year, so it's a big mess everywhere in the yard, and that tree looked so dead every winter. I mean, every winter, it's just a gnarly, it was a nasty looking tree without the leaves anyway. And you'd sit there and you'd look at it and just think, this thing, I think it maybe died this time around. I don't think it's going to come back from this. But then every spring, almost overnight, like as if somebody went out and just spattered it with bright green paint, all of a sudden, all over it are the green shoots of the leaves coming out. And then the blossoms that would come out on it. It was a Bradford pear tree, and so it had all these white blossoms that would come out. And so no matter how dismal or dreary the winter may have seemed, the summer was sure to come. It was going to come. See, we're Christians, we're actually sort of the opposite of Game of Thrones. We're walking around saying summer is coming. Either way, and if you don't get that, you're probably better off. But either way, no matter how bad the world seems to get, no matter how bad, no matter how hopeless, no matter how painful, how tumultuous this broken planet seems to be, there is a good ending assured to us. There's a good ending in store in his kingdom. If we'll believe in all the possibilities of his kingdom and all the possibilities of what God intends for this world that he made. Christ's words won't pass away, he says. In other words, they will come to pass. This is going to happen just like he said, just like has been predicted from the beginning of the Bible when we were told about the fall and everything going wrong. We were told from that point forward, God had something in mind. It's going to turn around. There is a good ending coming for this place. We sometimes tend to fixate on the doom forecasted in these prophecies by Jesus. And we forget this picture that he leaves us with here, this picture of hope, this picture of life, of something new. So we have to remember when the world, you know, and obviously you can't, we get little respites now and then, but by and large, my whole lifetime, you turn on the news and it's, you know, it's terrible stuff happening. It's a violent place. We live in a world that's just the way it is. There are terrible things that happen, and inhumane acts against humanity on a regular basis. It's been that way my whole life. And it happens all the time. When we want to stress about that, or we stress about the government seeming corrupt, or the news outlets seeming prejudiced, or we see the waters rising, or the gunfire continuing to clatter, we need to remember to lift up our heads, because his redemption is just that much closer. He's right at the gates, he said. He's at the door. And I don't mean to say that these signs are telling us that it's imminent. I'm saying that because the temple is gone, it's imminent. It's been imminent all this time. We need to remember that. There's something good awaiting us just over the horizon. We don't want to take our focus off of that. While the dead tree seems to be commanding our focus, we need to scan those branches for signs of green sprouts. Let's keep the good ending in view and then live in anticipation of that good ending. Cooperate with God's intent all along to bring that good to bear through our lives presently. To reflect in our lives what God's intention is, to take care of the world that we have, to take care of the people of this world, to reflect into this sadness the green shoots of new life that God intends to bring, so that any fear of the present state of this world gets eclipsed by our hope in a better world through Jesus. I'll tell you, if we can do that, if we can keep that in view, if we can keep that good ending in view, we'll keep the good news, good news. And with that kind of news, I believe we can turn the world upside down. If we embrace it, if we're willing to live it out, if we'll hold on to the possibilities that are found in God. Right on?
Yeah.
All right, very cool. Why don't you stand up with me, please?